From KQED FM in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this Wednesday, June 9th Forum, we meet author David Foster Wallace, the acclaimed fiction writer who gave us the novel Infinite Jest and has a new story collection out called Brief Interviews with Hideous Men. He'll be joining us next. We invite you to join us as well. That's After News from National Public Radio. From KQED-FM in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the program. A former grad student in philosophy at Harvard, David Foster Wallace, also a graduate of Amherst, wrote his first novel, The Broom of the System, in his mid-20s, followed by a story collection, Girl with Curious Hair, and the tome of a novel, Infinite Jest. Known for his experimental fiction, he has been described by The Village Voice as the funniest writer of his generation, and here in San Francisco, the Chronicle called him a consistently innovative, sensitive, and intelligent writer. He was a recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship, as well as winner of an O. Henry Award, the Lannan Award for Fiction, the John Train Prize for Humor, and the Paris Review's Aga Khan Prize. His work has appeared in the Paris Review, as well as in Esquire, Harper's, The New Republic, The New Yorker, and his newest book is a collection of stories called Brief Interviews with Hideous Men, and we welcome him to the program. David, it's good to have you here.
Thanks.
Actually, on the cover, I should mention, is a figure who looks like the old unknown comic from television.
From the Gong Show, yeah. We were just talking about that outside.
The guy with a bag over his head, and his identity is kept anonymous. What's the sense of that?
An author has so little control over the cover. You know, all I can do is howl if I really hate it, and this one I don't hate. I think the 90s are the time of literal covers. You know, if a book has anything to do with sex, there will be a big disheveled bed on the cover or something like that. And I think this is their idea of conveying hideousness.
Well, you've got a lot of stuff about sex in here. Maybe there should have been something along those lines.
A disheveled bed. I think they'd used a disheveled bed for Joanne Beard's Boys of My Youth, so that disheveled bed photo was used. Yeah, this is the first. I hadn't done much sex or love stuff in earlier books, and people had pointed that out, so this is my attempt to probe this area.
There's a lot of probing, and in fact, let's talk about what you probe in the cover, or the title story, I should mention, which, when you look at a book that says Brief Interviews with Hideous Men, you think that's what you're going to get a collection of, but this is the title story. There are points of view of a 13-year-old kid on a diving board, of a woman who is obsessed about her husband's pleasure with respect to sexuality and so forth. But here we have, in addition, in the title story, in addition to a masturbatory fantasy involving Elizabeth Montgomery from Bewitched, we have what looks like a transcript of a couple of, I guess, sort of intellectual graduate students. They talk a lot about Foucault and Lacan, but they're really talking about women and what women want.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, I don't know if I would even call that the title story. This is one of these weird books that they called it stories because they didn't know what else to call it. But it's more, the stories are, I think, a little more connected than your average book of short stories. I think there's maybe 24 or 25 of the interviews, and they're broken up into four chunks. And I guess it's supposed to sort of run the gamut from kind of rural knuckle draggers to intellectual grad students. I think, is that at Ann Arbor that those two guys are talking? I can't remember. I think it's somewhere in Michigan.
It doesn't specify, I don't think. In fact, a lot of these things read like transcripts more than they do stories, as you're suggesting. It's almost as if you're trying to get down actual dialogue or internal dialogue and get it on paper.
Yeah, it's hard to know how to respond without, you know, boring listeners, mindless. These are weird things only because they are interviewers. You don't hear the interviewer. If you read the book way more carefully than anybody's going to, certain characteristics of the interviewer emerge because of some of the comments the men make to her, but you don't hear her at all, and so you have to kind of figure out what questions she's asking from what the men say.
Sometimes you're actually in characters' minds, though. I mean, as opposed to what would pass for an interview.
Right? Well, I'm not sure that's true. In the interviews themselves, the interviews are aural, you know, AU. Those are just men talking. Some of the other stories, I mean, it's tricky because the interviews, I think, compose only about a third of the book, and another two thirds is sort of regular short stories that have to do with the interviews in weird ways. I don't think I'm giving a very good description of the book.
Well, it's hard to describe. It makes it difficult, I suppose, for people from Little Brown to market it, and yet they've done a good job marketing you. Like you said, you have this I would call it vast readership. You're a modest man, but, you know, quite a number of what you describe as what, white, nerdy graduate students in English and philosophy.
William Hurt in The Big Chill said he had a small, deeply disturbed following.
And that is true of David Foster Wallace?
Yeah, I guess to an extent. There are plenty of people, writers in the country who do the sort of stuff I do, or at least do stuff as weird as I do. I am one of a couple who was lucky enough to find, you know, major, like, big corporation publishers who are not only willing to take a chance on the stuff, but found ways to, you know, somehow Little Brown found a way to make the largeness and difficulty of Infinite Jest like a marketing hook, which, if you think about it, is marketing genius or else incredible marketing luck. I mean, it seemed to me to be a suicidal strategy when they explained what they were going to do. My idea was to market it as a potential aerobic step stool so that people could actually, you know, take it with them on the side. I'm afraid I'm not kidding.
No, it's 1,079 pages, yeah. So it could work as an aerobic step stool.
And not a fast 1,079. But the point is that they found a way to make that, you know, whatever passes for hip or cool in the literary community, and I still don't quite understand how they did it. So,
well, one of the things that happened with that book was, I mean, aside from being a very funny book and futuristic and having a good deal of social satire in it, it seemed to catch on in large part because of all the analogies to Pynchon, which you have underplayed and you have been very modest about.
Well, I don't know if it's modesty. In fact, I think it's probably sticking out the lower lip arrogance. My first book in the New York Times got called a ripoff of The Crying of Lot 49, which at that time I had not read. And that started my whole kind of pugnacious attitude about it. I was very
interested. Zeitgeist ripoff.
Yeah. Or, you know, I'd been interested in Gravity's Rainbow when I was an undergraduate. And I got nothing against Pynchon, and I'm sure he's a fine writer. There are writers who I think I come out of the sort of forehead of and possibly even rip off in certain ways, but I don't think Pynchon is one of them. And when I deny very much resemblance, it's not being modest. It's more like sort of wanting to be my own little person.
Well, you said you both like math. Who are the writers that are in your forehead, then?
Oh, Lord. I set myself up for that one, didn't I?
You did.
I would say probably Donald Barthelemy, short story-wise, and Julio Cortázar. A lot of the Latins, a lot of it has to do with when I was going to school. When I was going to school, regular new criticism in English departments was just beginning to be supplanted by, like, first-generation Derridian deconstruction. And Latin American fiction, the post-Borgesians, were very big. And there was sort of a renaissance of the black humorists of the 60s. There was new interest in the Bacoff and Pynchon and Barth and all those guys. And I got exposed by...
Fabulists, they're called.
Yeah, well, that's one. Or black humorists or...
Well, Bartholomew, you know, is certainly a black humorist. Bartholomew once said, and I kind of thought about this, actually, in reading this new collection of yours, only truth in fragments.
Yeah. Some of the stuff is fragmentary. Some of it is just wanting... having done... some very, like, hyper-circuited, long, loquacious stuff. I wanted to try to do some shorter stuff. I mean, there was really no more complicated agenda than that.
Well, you've gone from, I guess, a novel to short stuff to a novel to short stuff. And you also did a book on rap. I'm not familiar with that.
Well, that's...
What was that?
That was an ill-advised essay that a friend and I wrote that the Echo Press decided they wanted. It was about what it's like to be a white kid interested in rap and why on earth we as privileged white kids would be interested in rap. And it...
Well, help us. Why
it
were you?
Fell stillborn from the presses. And, oh, boy. I basically what we ended up doing was realizing that there were some really deep questions about the relationship between street culture, most commonly Afro-American culture, and then white, bland, mass merchandise culture, and that in a lot of ways it was kind of one chased the other, and that the street culture had an investment in knowing what the commercial culture was so that it could, like, diss it and move on beyond it. Anyway, it all got sort of very complicated. And the only symptoms I can see of it anymore are that a lot of my students who very often are from Chicago suburbs and are privileged middle-class males dress and speak and affect the demeanor of urban black males. Complete with gangbanger, you know, the finger gestures and all that stuff, which I'm 37. I have no idea what that stuff's about.
Talking to David Foster Wallace, his new book is called Brief Interviews with Hideous Men. You do, in this new collection, though, really get into what I would describe as the interior, the consciousness of so many different kinds of characters. And we might talk about this for a moment. I mean, it's as if you're speaking in many different voices, and obviously you want to do that.
Well, I guess the book for me is unified as a book. For me, anyway, it's about a certain kind of loneliness that's a loneliness that's constituted out of situations that are supposed to be involve love, specifically sexual love and parent-child love. But it's supposed to be, and again, I'm talking about how it is for me, not how any reader's going to see it. But I think it's supposed to be kind of, if that particular area of darkness is a jewel, it's supposed to be that jewel from a number of different facets. And most of the differences and most of the facets involve differences in voices. The interlocutor, who for me is kind of, I'm really into the interlocutor, these interviews whom nobody else even hears or sees, but these men are not seen, they're heard exclusively through her, and so there's a lot of attention to the voice. You know what, I have no idea whether this is making any sense.
No, it is, actually. I mean, it's not only men, though, that we're talking about. I say there's this woman, for example, who is obsessed about the fact that she may not be sexually pleasing her husband, and she goes off to this place called Adult World, where she winds up buying various objects to presumably enhance her sex life. But you've also got, like I said, 13-year-old kid up on a diving board in a scene that many of us recognize, looking down, being afraid to go off the diving board and so forth. So it seems, once again, as if you're really capturing or trying to capture many different kinds of facets of human behavior, though I would agree with you that the focus is on love and on sex.
Maybe, or else a certain, I don't know, a certain kind of loneliness. The book, besides Jerzy Kaczynski's Steps, which is a big book for me, and not many people remember it, but it's also very fragmentary and kind of almost parable-ish.
It's a National Book Award winner.
Yeah, but from a long time ago. At least none of my students have ever heard of it.
You know the great story about Steps. There was a magazine called California, what was it? The New West, I'm sorry, which isn't published anymore. And there was an experiment where they sent the manuscript of Steps over the transom to a bunch of major publishers
just
to see what kind of response they would get. It was a number of years after it had been published, and it was turned down universally. In fact, only one editor said, sounds vaguely like Kaczynski, or has, you know, qualities like Kaczynski.
I heard of somebody once doing that with a Joyce Carol Oates book, of like retyping it and sending out and it getting dissed. But no, I'm embarrassed. I don't know that much about Kaczynski. I saw being there when I was in college. I found this book at a garage sale. And I like the cover. The cover had a woman in a cage and a devilish-looking guy. And you know, Little Brown will not be pleased that I'm sitting here plugging a 30-year-old book by somebody else. This is like an incredible book.
Now, these are really hideous men.
This is just about the creepiest book I've ever read in my life. But there's another one called 11 Kinds of Loneliness by Richard Yates, and he's another writer I don't know that much about, but I've always just been obsessed by the title. And until I came to my senses, the working title of this book was 24 Kinds of Loneliness, because it's 24 different sorts of stories. And even though the voices are very different and the consciousnesses are very different, at least for me, it's basically a book about loneliness. And you know, the woman in Adult World isn't just worried about not pleasing her husband. She suspects that her husband isn't being entirely faithful to her, and and has an epiphany about that. It's really my attempt to do an epiphany story. And
you even use the word epiphany. Yeah,
except, well, the second part's an outline, because I was so nervous about trying to do an epiphany straight, I could only do the outline of the epiphany. But
makes you feel a little overshadowed by Joyce when you use that word.
Yeah. Well, it's so hard these days to have a character stand at a window and suddenly, you know, have realization break across her features without just coming off. I mean, how many times has something like that been parodied in on Saturday Night Live or in how to do genuine, intense, emotional stuff in art fiction these days is a really interesting question. And some of the shucking and jiving in this book is you're watching a very nervous writer who's trying to talk about emotional stuff and is also terrified of coming off sentimental.
But you've got control, you know. You have control over the tone. There are a couple of stories, for example, there's a story that won O. Henry Award about the depressed person. We don't even know what gender for a while this depressed person is. And I found, you know, the whole sense of control that you were able to exercise pretty remarkable. There's a piece about a poet just sitting alone in a Speedo I think it's a copy of Newsweek, on his stomach or something. And again, you know, there's this sense of control over the emotion or the sentiment, which obviously comes off. I mean, I think you do very well.
Well, thank you. And obviously, I'm more pleased with that response than the opposite. I know for instance, the people who don't like my stuff, of whom there are not a few, view it as just heavily stylized, and there's a great deal of emphasis on sort of technique and different points of view and stuff. And to an extent, deep down, I kind of know what they're talking about, because this book, I think, is stylistically pretty fine. I'm pretty happy with it. But some of the emphasis on style and line by line, light show is meant to take attention away from or compensate for the fact that some of these stories are really almost sentimental in terms of dealing with kind of gooey solar plexus like stuff that I just, as somebody who was raised on, you know, Saturday Night Live and the Letterman Show and the black humorists in the 60s who, you know, dined out on carving up, you know, these old standard sentimental.
Think about like Vonnegut and Bruce J. Friedman.
Yeah, sure. And Barth and Barthelemy and Pynchon, and then, you know, McGuane, you know, all early Jim Harrison. I mean, all of these guys. And these guys were kind of, as a writer, they're kind of my fathers or my father's generation. They were the ones who, as a reader, I was really interested in. I'm not really interested in doing the kind of stuff that they do, but I'm very conscious of, I think, being in their shadow. And or of their having robbed me and other literary readers of an innocence that can never again be recaptured.
It's sort of sad when you put it that way. Though there is a moment. There's a piece that gets kind of sentimental for me. Let me talk with you about it and sort of describe it for our listeners. There's a piece where a guy is very vague about having given somebody or helped somebody with generosity get some money. And he doesn't want to be specific about it. He doesn't want to disclose who he is and so forth. And, in fact, doesn't want to disclose to the person who got the money, but inadvertently does so. And then he feels as if he's sort of evil almost for having done this because he wanted it to be pure. He wanted, yeah, you know, the charity and generosity to be pure. Yeah. I was very touched by that story. And yet, in a way, it comes across as somewhat sentimental.
Well, this may be a generational thing. I, from your face, I can't tell whether you mean sentimental as a criticism or not. From my generation, when I hear
an observation, sentimental is a bad word to you, though.
Yeah, when I hear the S word, I wince. It's involuntary. That story, that's an okay story.
It just means it has sentiment in it, though. You know?
Well, that's interesting. Sentimentality, at least for me, or what I was taught in my little workshops, is sentimentality is, as Updike said, loving your characters more than God loves them. And from the reader's point of view, sentimentality, I think, is really associated with being manipulated by certain kinds of art. You know, having your emotions fumbled at the way, like a co-ed's brassiere or something. You know, some kind of clumsy.
You mean to tell me artists shouldn't be manipulative or aren't manipulative?
I think all art is really manipulative. Bad art, the person can tell they're being manipulated, right? I mean, it's all sort of a continuum. What I'm talking about, though, is I can imagine writers 40 or 50 years ago feeling a visceral horror of say being obscene or unpatriotic or vulgar or in poor taste. You know, the whole visceral definitions of obscenity that it just seems to me that for my generation and maybe the writers younger than me, that kind of horror we feel for the sentimental and the sappy and the gooey and the, you know, the bridges of Madison County-ish and to attempt to try to do fiction about human beings who are sometimes in pain and have sometimes emotional experiences that are powerful because they're not unique and because they're not complicated, and to do that in a way that doesn't come off as the sort of thing that Dan Aykroyd was parodying into oblivion 20 years ago, you know, I would just say it's a problem.
Well, when you don't, for example, when you write about the depressed person or when you write about a guy with one arm, that's when you're least sentimental. I mean, everything is just pretty straightforward.
Well, and now I'm painting myself into a corner because, yeah, it would be there's a lot of grotesquerie in this book, and I sure hope the grotesquerie is not meant to somehow attenuate sentimentality or something. I mean, I'm interested in grotesquerie for sort of other reasons, but to go back, I mean, to go back to The Devil is a Busy Man, which I think is the one. There are two stories about sort of the devil and giving and the impossibility of giving, and this is supposed to be a subset of the loneliness. The thing about that story that is most striking to me is that it's very heavily stylized. The guy's not very literate. He makes a lot of mistakes. There are a lot of sort of grammar mistakes in the story, and in a way that's all right, and it creates the character. But another way, looking back at it, I can just tell that I was so terrified that this was going to come off sentimental that I wanted I wanted to have other stuff going on in the story. And for me, the easy stuff to have going on is the syntactic stuff and the stylistic stuff and whatever. And I'm not arguing with you or saying it's not a good story. I'm just aware that I'm just aware that a lot of the choices I think that I make in dealing with this stuff come really out of a very deep kind of fear that I don't think is just mine.
There are a lot of fears that are evidenced in this book. One of them is really in the title piece or whatever about women and the sense that women, on the one hand, we talked to Germaine Greer yesterday, so this is pretty fresh in a different way in my mind, but that women are being given these mixed messages, a kind of cultural schizophrenia. On the one hand, being told that they should be autonomous and independent, and on the other hand, you know, being told that they should be Cosmo girls and trap men and, you know, make sure that they have a mate and so forth. And this is told in a rather sensitive way. I mean, in terms of guys discussing it at the same time, of course, they're just bewildered by it and you get the sense of their puzzlement.
You're talking about the interviews with the grad students where they're talking. Well, the grotesque thing about that, though, is they're talking about it in terms of how to use that, how to deploy that fact in the quest to get laid.
Yeah.
Which is really kind of, I mean, I hate to put it that baldly, but that's sort of the thing that unifies all the different interviews. And so some of the men are actually, I think, very acute and perceptive about the situation of women in American culture.
But, well, like this guy who has a woman move out west to be with him, I guess it is, gives up her cat and everything and goes to meet him, and then he tells her, you know, I have this whole pattern of spurning women, and, you know, I'm just letting you know.
And I'm so terrified that that's going to happen that I'm going to spurn you now to keep from spurning you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That, there's a tinge of autobiography about that one that I really kind of
didn't want to ask, David, but
that was long ago.
You've metamorphosed a lot since then. Well, you talked about Saturday Night Live a few times to talk about Metamorphosis. That show just isn't funny anymore, is it?
Well, see, this is the thing. Is you know, it's one of the reasons I'm nervous coming on radio shows talking about this stuff. Is, you know, yeah, Dan Aykroyd parodied stuff, but I'll bet a lot of your listeners don't even remember. You know, this stuff is fairly fresh to me because I was 18, 19, 20, you know, when Saturday Night Live was at its zenith. And, you know, for your listeners who are younger than that, the 1-2 punch of Saturday Night Live and the David Letterman show did a number on I think the American psyche and the American sense of humor, like, you know, like maybe nothing else. And a lot of it consisted in making really ingenious fun of hypocrisies and kind of old fashioned quaint, you know, the sort of commercial where the woman strokes her chin and says, you know, oh, gosh, Bob never says that about my meatloaf and stuff like that. And it was totally brilliant and it was totally, you know, exhilarating for me to watch. But like the black humorous of the 60s, it I think introduced a kind of carapace of irony into the, well, the upscale term is cultural discourse. You know, the ways you and I talk to each other and the way we talk to each other as a group, whether through art or in public discussions, that I just don't think the country's recovered from. And I may be wacko about this. I've never heard anybody else who thinks, you know, who really thinks Saturday Night Live was a pivotal moment.
Seminal moment in American culture.
Well, that was your adjective, not mine.
To open up the phone lines and find out what some of you think. I know there's some, certainly, David Foster Wallace fans out there, and it's an opportunity to talk to him about
the hostile or welcome
his
to
work. Yeah, I guess he wants criticism if you've got it. 415-863-2476 is the number to call. Again, you can join us now and are cordially invited to do so at 415-863-2476. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The new book is called Brief Interviews with Hideous Men, and I ought to mention that he'll be at a clean, well-lighted place this evening at 7:30. You going to be reading there or just...
I think I'll be doing whatever I'm told to do. Usually it's reading for about 20 minutes and then smiling and nodding a lot at people.
And reading from the new collection.
I imagine I'll be encouraged to do that, yeah.
Let's get some calls here. Steve, you're first up. Hi.
Hi there. It's great to speak to you, David. I enjoyed your book, Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, and the essays on the going on the cruise and the state fair were fantastic. The one I enjoyed the most, though, was the one on the tennis players. And I probably was not as good a tennis player as you when I was a kid, but I do enjoy playing now, and it gave such great insight. For those who didn't see the essay, it was also on Esquire, by the way. It told how, you followed a guy who was number 138 or so on the pro tennis rankings and followed him for a tournament. And talked about how the difference between number 138 and number one is probably an inch or two on a stroke, and how those that are down at the bottom are kind of just the feeder in the, into the system, and that they have to be there, but they will never rise to being in the top 10. And can you give us an update on any of those guys, and tell us your funnest memory of that essay?
Wow. I don't know. There were three or four young players that that was originally commissioned by a magazine called Details. I don't even know if Details
exists
anymore. The sordid truth is, in fact, the guy that I ended up following around had never been interviewed before, and he told me like a bunch of stuff he shouldn't have told me. And then my mistake, not like horrible felony stuff, like I don't want to get the guy in trouble, but stuff that like it would have really hurt his feelings if I'd printed. And like a schmo who hadn't done much interviewing, I told Details that I had all this dirt, but I wasn't going to run it. And then the whole thing fell apart with Details, and so, and then Esquire stepped in and rescued the thing. I don't have a TV, so I don't watch much tennis. Vince Padilla was another one of the players they wanted me to follow. I ended up going with Michael Joyce just for pretentious literary reasons because of his last name. I don't think Joyce's career has been doing all that well. And I can't remember a favorite moment of that essay other than watching Joyce kind of practice and fool around with his coach and realizing just the sheer amount of fun he was having.
Are you a tennis fan still? I mean, do you follow it?
I follow it somewhat. The weird thing with me is I played a whole lot as a kid. I wasn't great. Like, I wasn't nationally ranked or anything, but it was, you know, the ways, like, some girls are really into figure skating. I mean, this was my thing, and this is what I did, and I trained. And I think by the time I was, like, in college, I kind of burned out on the actual... I sort of burned out on the game, but the kind of the theory of the game and the theory of particularly children who, with their parents' either encouragement or coercion, are pushed into excellence at an age when really a child doesn't have the equipment to make a free will type choice is very interesting to me. It's not what happened to me, but it's what happened to a lot of my friends, some of whom became very, very good players.
Steve, let me thank you for the call. We'll take more calls when we return here. We're going to just cut away for a few moments if you'd like to join us. We're talking with David Foster Wallace. His new book is called Brief Interviews with Hideous Men, and our number is 863-2476. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest is David Foster Wallace, author of Infinite Jest and a new collection called Brief Interviews with Hideous Men, talking about some of the more memorable, strange pieces in this new collection. There's one about a young man who suddenly remembers his father, try to be euphemistic about this, wagging his manhood or his member or whatever in the young man's face. And I mean, I said to David, where do these stories come from? And the answer is, I guess, you don't know where they come from, at least the shorter ones, right? They just emerge.
Well, yeah, it's very strange. Stuff that's longer has to sustain a kind of logic that for me requires more cognitive stuff. Some of the short and there's longer stuff in this, but some of the really short stuff is much more. That story just started with an image and then a terror that, you know, my father would think I was talking about him, which I'm not, Dad.
Yeah, you say you have to have dinner with your dad. Skip on a car phone joining us. Hi, Skip.
Hi, thank you. Good morning. I haven't read your book yet, David, but it sounds absolutely fascinating. Just because of the title, I think a lot of males, if they were honest with themselves, would have to acknowledge they carry a lot of those funny little hideous men around inside them, and they come to the surface in various forms. My comment is on the sort of cross currents about sentimentality. I'm inclined to think that the sort of destruction of sentimentality is probably even worse than you describe on the one hand, and it's far more ubiquitous than just Saturday Night Live, that the mass media tends to burn our nerve endings off with a blowtorch every day, and it makes it hard to respond sentimentally to anything. On the other hand, if you look at the tremendous popularity of the video versions of, say, 19th century English novels, the Bronte novels and some of the others that have been hugely successful and are transparently and abundantly sentimental, you know, there's clearly an interest in the general public to sort of consume and become involved in that kind of sentimentality. I'm not sure where it comes out, whether it's in between or the hostility towards and the hunger for sentimentality coexist, but I'd like to hear what you think about that. There really is a lot of transparent sentimentality out in the public media, and what does that mean in terms of the comments you made earlier?
All right, Skip, we'll have David opine on that again, on sentimentality.
I'm required to opine. My response to that question is a little bit like my response to Mr. Krasny's before. It sounds to me like you and I are using sentimentality in a different kind of visceral way. For me, sentimentality is a bad thing. Sentimentality is goo. Sentimentality is
bathos.
Is bathos. There you go. And hugs and, you know, 10 years of mourning over the death of a pet bunny at age 11 and all that kind of stuff. That for me, what's pernicious is that sometimes stuff that's just about emotions gets muted because of our fear of appearing sentimental. And for me, there's a certain amount of sentimentality in the culture, probably more where I live than here, but involves things like Martha Stewart and Hallmark cards and, oh, isn't that cute, and sweater vests for poodles and Lifetime television and all this stuff. And for me, the kind of surfeit of goo in the culture is sort of the flip side of the fact that we don't really have any more a way to talk earnestly about very simple, deep, emotional stuff like sadness and fear outside of, you know, I don't know, shrink's offices.
Chris, you may be more inured, too, to our emotions. That's part of it, you think?
I think it's possible. I get very suspicious of the reason we are this way is it's the damn media, and the media, the media, you know, burns our neurons with a blowtorch. As far as I can see, the media is this dumb beast that is only trying to figure out how we can be pleased and trying to please us. And I think...
Well, your grad students in that title piece blame the media, though, at least.
Well, it's extremely easy to do. Newsflash, most of the men in these interviews are not speaking for me. I mean...
Didn't mean to suggest they're enemies, but they were. But they're bright men. I mean, they're certainly perceptive men and not necessarily... as perceptive about themselves as perhaps we'd like them to be. But.
Well, it's I can tell by your facial expression, know very well that intellectual attainment and having your head up your butt are completely compatible, you know. Anyway, I don't know if that's an answer to your question. I guess it's just when I see, like, remakes of Jane Austen novels and stuff, it doesn't seem to me to be sentimentality. The weird thing is why we can't have a straightforward kind of earnest, unironic exploration of some of that stuff that's in a contemporary setting. Why we have to go back and unearth Jane Austen and have everybody in bodices and trains for it to be okay to have stuff be that kind of warm and simplistic.
Except for things, of course, like the phenomenon of what you mentioned, the Bridges of Madison County.
Yeah,
which Elizabeth Wurtzel said was the most evil book ever published, or something along those lines.
I don't know how to respond to what Elizabeth Wurtzel says about anything, there's some way in which that kind of thing in a contemporary setting has been polluted by commercialism, and it is true that most of the stuff. But you know what? It's different. The Bridges of Madison County is pretentious and sentimental, whereas something like I don't know, Steps or 11 Kinds of Loneliness or. What am I trying to think of? Like even a movie like Broadcast News, which okay had its ironies and had its quirks and is maybe 10 or 15 years old, but was about various kinds of sadness and various kinds of people bumbling around trying not to be sad, and the ending was sad, and it seemed to me to be one of the few moments where a popular movie succeeded in presenting people as like emotional entities who were driven mostly by emotion, but it wasn't a goo fest and it wasn't a poke, poke, nudge, nudge, look what unsophisticated dweebs these people are. And I'm sorry, I rambled at the end.
No, you can't. It's funny, when you mentioned Broadcast News, I was seeing Albert Brooks with all that sweat pouring down his brow. Glenn from Oakland, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. If I could put my question aside for a second, I feel compelled to respond to something that Mr. Wallace just said about...
And I'll be responding to your response.
Sounds fair enough. It seems to me that you're drawing some distinction between sentiment where it's used as a manipulative device as it is in the kind of entertainment you just cited and where it's used in perhaps more serious literature. But I was reminded of one of the characters in Infinite Jest, Don Gately. And it seemed to me that sort of the way you reveal that character throughout the book, you've got this guy who's clearly totally screwed up and on a certain level really sick. He's a drug abuser, et cetera, et cetera. But you can't help. It seems like there's a very deliberate attempt to manipulate you into feeling incredibly moved by this guy by the end.
What do you mean manipulate?
Well, I don't know. I had the feeling that my emotions were being played with, and I was being put in a position where I was rooting for a character and feeling sorry for a character that really didn't, in the big picture, given what else is going on in the book, it didn't really make sense to me.
Huh. Well, it sounds to me like then we have a case of where the book for you fails. There's a fine line between, I think, being able to write a book where the reader begins genuinely to feel for a character, which doesn't mean falls in love with the character or, you know, thinks the character is the best person who ever came down the pike, but has some kind of, I don't know, emotional identification or recognition of self in the character. But if the reader, as you did, gets the feeling that the author's pulling those strings and getting that feeling that we all hate so much, that our emotions are being manipulated for somebody else's selfish ends, then at that point, at least for me as a reader, if I get that vibe off a book, I put the book down.
Well, you got some criticism, at least from Glenn. Thank you, Glenn.
But it's valid criticism. I mean, if he's got that feeling, the book for him sinks like a stone.
Of course, you know, that's him as a reader, too. It doesn't.
Of course, he's terribly, terribly wrong.
And he's
about
wrong.
What the actual
I was waiting for you to say that. Since you mentioned Infinite Jest, before I go to another caller, what is it with you in these Talmudic footnotes of yours? I mean, you know, certainly it's become kind of a signature, hasn't it, in a way?
In Infinite Jest, it was an intentional thing. And, you know, I can give you kind of BS-y theoretical reasons for why to do it. The simplest one was it was a book about tennis, and there was a certain amount of back and forth between the main text and the footnotes. The truth of the matter is, though, is that I discovered, I'm not very good with computers, but I discovered that this old computer I had actually had a footnote function, and that's when I was doing Infinite Jest, and it gets to be very, very tempting to want to cross T's and dot I's in footnotes, or to set up this kind of second smart-ass meta voice that comments on the main text. And in the essay...
So you yielded to temptation.
Well, it got to be this thing where it got to be a bit of a shtick. And the minute people started giving me, you know, kidding me about it, of course, I wanted to quit it. But you kind of get in this head. It's, you know, it's not quite schizoid, but it becomes very tempting to kind of... I don't know about you, but when I have a thought, then very often there's another part of me that watches myself have that thought and reacts to that thought. And being able to have a main text and a footnote has sort of the same kind of attraction. Of course, you've got to consider the poor reader, you know, and what are you going to do? Eventually have footnotes to the footnotes to the footnotes. And at a certain point, the reader just gets annoyed and throws the book at the wall. So I've instituted a no more footnote rule for myself. But we'll see if that...
We'll see if you hold to it. Let's go to more of your calls. Our Bohemian Bard is next up here. Diamond Dave, you're on the air.
Hey, yo, David Foster West. The way I deal with sentiment for myself, I notice what I say is, hey, that really touched me. And that way I'm not talking about sentiment, I'm talking about something else. But I wanted to ask you something, Michael. On the back cover of Infinite Jest, there's a picture of somebody. He looks like kind of a hippie, almost kind of a deadhead, somebody I knew on Dead Tour. And it says David Foster West. Does he really look like that?
I'm trying to picture the back of Infinite Jest, and I can't see it, but I don't think so.
Okay. Hey, an author I think of the kind of grandfather of them all. You mentioned Yeats. And David, have you ever read anything by William Gaddis?
I've dabbled in a bit of Gaddis, yeah.
J.R. particularly reminds me a bit, which is entirely voice.
The interesting thing is... yeah, some of the stuff I do is all in dialogue. I actually, it is a complete ripoff, but it's for me a ripoff of Manuel Puig, whom I discovered at a much younger age than I discovered Gaddis. I didn't read J.R. until I was in my late 20s, but Manuel Puig, who's best known for Kiss of the Spider Woman, which was made into a really famous movie, is an Argentine writer of whom I think four books are entirely in dialogue. Whether he ripped it off from Gaddis, I don't know. The two of them would have to work that out.
Actually, Roth wrote a book completely in dialogue.
Which one is that?
A lot of people don't know that. Betrayal, I think.
Yeah, there's something else I wanted to ask that occurred to me when the Internet was mentioned. That with the Internet now, there's ways in which people who are turned on or by a particular author can connect with one another. Like, I'm sure there's many pension websites. And I wondered, I bet, and I wanted to ask you, whether there's a David Wallace, David Foster website where people can connect, because that's a whole new level where somebody reads a book separate all the way around the world and connect to other people who have also been turned on, have entered the world of a particular...
Well, let's find out, Dave. Are you aware of a website to your...
I mean, I've been told, I think I and a little old lady in Dubuque are the only people who don't have a modem. Other than occasionally hiring somebody to get me on a database, I've never been on the Internet. I don't know anything about this stuff.
I'll bet there are, David Foster Wallace, things on the Internet. Thank you, Diamond Dave. Ian from San Mateo, our next caller. Good morning and welcome to Forum.
Hi. I had a question about your first novel, I Could Take You Back That Far. I was reading it, and I noticed...
That's The Broom of the System.
Sorry. Broom of the System, the first novel. And Ludwig Wittgenstein sort of... The philosopher from earlier this century sort of is a figure in the back of that novel, kind of in the shadows of that novel all throughout it. But I noticed a lot of sort of curious mistakes about Wittgenstein. For instance, the grandmother of the main character is supposed to have an autographed copy of the Philosophical Investigations, but it was published after that book was published after Wittgenstein had died. And there's a few other things along those lines. I was wondering, first of all, were those intentional? And if they were, what was the point of the sort of errors about Wittgenstein, especially since he talks so much about language? And
the particular mistake you're talking about was indeed intentional. And the reason I'm wincing is I'm trying to put myself back in the psyche of like a 22 or 23 year old kid, and what that kid thought was cool. The first draft of that book was done when I was in college, and a lot of the work that I was doing in college was in Wittgenstein and Kurt Gödel. And I know a fair amount of the Wittgenstein stuff that's in the book is just kind of spillover from some of the work I was doing in different departments. I also know that some of the mistakes were meant to be kind of were meant to kind of jazz it up. I wasn't interested in doing something that was just kind of a one-to-one correspondence of, you know, find the section in the Tractatus that, you know, that this refers to, find the section in the Brown Book that refers to. I'm sure there were some other Wittgenstein mistakes that weren't intentional.
When you went, let me thank Ian. When you went and did graduate work in philosophy at Harvard, was it also Wittgenstein that you were involved in? Or
I wasn't at Harvard very long. I was having trouble writing, and I had this idea that if I went back to school, which was an environment in which I had thrived, it would help me write. And of course, I was way out of my league. I was 27 years old, and Harvard was willing to assign, you know, more than enough stuff to keep one ever from writing anything ever again. My specialty when I did, you know, philosophy was math logic,
what you said sort of connects you to Pynchon in some ways. You're both fascinated with math and math logic.
From what I know of Pynchon was a physics major in college who worked for Boeing. I mean, applied math and math logic, you know, like the line from Ghostbusters, applied mathematicians, they expect results, you know, whereas the pure math logic stuff is very, you know, it's all proofs. And anyway, that's what I was going to go back and do. And
that's Dan Aykroyd's had a more significant influence on Wittgenstein, since you mentioned Ghostbusters.
Yeah, I seem to be trapped in the early 80s in terms of what I'm thinking of this morning. I don't know what it is.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny with David Foster Wallace. His new book is Brief Interviews with Hideous Men. And just to remind you, those people who know him and appreciate him, he'll be at a clean, well-lighted place tonight at 7:30. Joanna, in the meantime, is with us here. Hi, Joanna.
Hi, how you doing? I had a question, sort of a question comment. I think one of my favorite stories by you is Westward, The Course of Empire Takes Its Way, and how you play with Lost in the Funhouse and how you sort of struggle with that irony that we were talking about earlier. And I'm just curious, as a Columbia MFA program dropout,
Congratulations.
how you think of workshops in relation to this kind of infinite self-reflexive puzzle that we as writers get stuck in, and how those contribute to that and the other path.
Here's the problem with being on a show like this is the good question. I mean, we could now fire up a pot of coffee and talk for 3 hours about this. I don't know how to give a 30-second answer. That God bless you for having read that story. I don't even think my parents have read that story. Much of it has to do with a creative writing student who's grappling with John Barth's Lost in the Funhouse, which was kind of the first piece of popular metafiction, which is the fiction that reminds you that. I'm not telling you, Mr. Krasny, I'm saying that as background for those. Here's the weird thing. When I was in grad school, the pernicious influence of workshops seemed to me to be what one guy called like the McStory and the McPoem. You know, you needed your sensitive, somehow Freudianly wounded protagonist who was a convenient, you know, locus for various emotions. And there was the whole Freytag triangle of, you know, there had to be rising action. There was an epiphanic climax and a denouement. And at least in the school that I went to, this sounds bitter, but it's really true. If your story didn't correspond to that model, you got squished. Now, I teach at a school now where the weird thing is I'm like the resident, like, traditional realist. We're like, because I teach at a very avant-garde school.
Where do you teach?
I teach at Illinois State, which... most people haven't heard of, but it's like Dalkey Archive Press is there, and they're a big, and Fiction Collective too, and some really avant-garde kind of
the original Ron Sukunik Fiction Collective.
Well, it's now FC2. Kurt White took it over and moved it to ISU. Many of the students that we get now, it seems to me that now, at least where I teach, the workshop is no less really a pernicious influence, but it's now almost the opposite. For one thing, at the school that I teach at, some of the other profs relentlessly politicize everybody's story and want the author to be able to defend their portrayals of like every gender and ethnicity choice and to be able to discuss and anticipate the theoretical, you know, implications of it. And what I watch it do is it either freezes the kids or it makes them like enormous throbbing neocortexes who are really good at 60s vintage. This is text, you're reading text, we are all text, let's manipulate the text, game playing with like absolutely nothing. There's absolutely no blood in it at all.
No juice. No, nothing that's alive.
Except then when I demand juice, when I demand juice, my worry is that I'm, you know, being Robert Waller and demanding the sentimentality or whatever. So it's very interesting. I think workshops, one workshop for a student and two workshops for a teacher, you learn a hell of a lot teaching workshops for two semesters. And then I think it becomes, for almost everybody, it becomes a damaging thing.
Joanna, let me thank you. We want to go to Oakland next and welcome Wendy on the air here. Hi.
Hi, I'm a member of your small, deeply disturbed following, David Foster Wallace.
And she said she's a member of your small, deeply disturbed following.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Thank you.
And I'm calling to ask why you changed the title of Signifying Nothing from Nothing Happened. And also, I'd like to talk about your appearances on the Charlie Rose Show.
Ooh. So you want to talk about the story first, and then after that, you're going to bring up the Charlie Rose debacle?
Yeah, if we have time.
You had a debacle with Charlie.
The story she's referring to is the infamous one where the father's organ pops out in the kid's face. You know what is just, I have a hard time with titles, and Nothing Happened was its title in some magazine, and I just didn't like it. And maybe signifying nothing had a little bit more like Shakespearean juice to it, or I thought it sounded better, or whatever.
Or Faulkner.
I wish. Yeah, right. Ooh, I didn't even think of that.
But Nothing Happened is the antithesis of Joseph Heller's second novel, Something Happened.
Yeah, I guess it's just pretty
you
hard
keep
not
playing
to,
with intertextual
it's pretty hard
stuff,
not to have an illusion in something, isn't it? You know what? The real answer is, I don't know.
Well, what about the Charlie Rose Show? I didn't see your appearance, so why do you call it a debacle?
Oh, it was just... Because... I don't want to say mean things about Charlie. I'm sure Charlie Rose is a very nice guy. When you watch the show, it looks like this probing intellectual discussion. And in fact, poor old Charlie Rose rarely has time even to read the covers of the books and has got staffers who are preparing these questions and ends up asking questions that are just almost unanswerable, and you're in a room that's completely black except for this blinding spotlight on this gleaming wooden table, and it's about 115 degrees in there. I was wearing two shirts. Do people care? I was wearing two shirts on the Charlie Rose Show, and they were both completely soaked by the time I was done with the show.
It's the Albert Brooks Broadcast News again.
It's another reason why Broadcast News is a big film. Anyway, I don't know what Joanna's question was about it, but I don't even know if she's still there.
Joanna, I guess, has... Are you still there? What did, yeah, we got seconds left. What do you want to know about the Charlie Rose?
Well, it just The first time that you appeared with the other two authors,
oh, right.
seemed quite confident. And the second time, actually, you were wincing every other second. I was wondering what that was all about.
Well, I'm pretty good friends with Franzen. And mm-hmm. Franzen and Mark Lehner and I were on before. And Franzen and I got to make fun of Mark Lehner. And
yeah.
so being on that show alone is just a real different trip than being on it with somebody you can roll your eyes at when things get silly. Trust
let me thank Wendy and let me thank David Foster Wallace for the time you spent with us. It's been delightful and much continued success with your work. You'll be at Clean Well Lighted Place tonight at 7:30. The new book is Brief Interviews with Hideous Men. We appreciate very much your being with us.
Kind of you, thanks.
Our producers are Robin Giannatasio-Mal, David Minko, and Holly Kernan-Waitala. We are here with you, of course, Monday through Friday. We want to thank our interns, Kate Davidson, Jesse Fancushion, Lauren Lempert, Elaine Lewinick, and Joy Mollets. Thank Norm Howard on controls, and Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. From KQED-FM in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.